I am making this video in response to the sort of conceited and downright wrong comments I've seen on Twitter about the emergence of capitalism from feudalism. It was encapsulated by this tweet, which got no fewer than 9 likes from various hammer and sickle types. You can see that the claim was until that Napoleon was around, so we're talking the early 19th century, no one other than local lords was in control of trade and economy. Now this really is not true, and here I want to lay out a few of the ways in which it isn't. First of all, it's important to establish feudalism. What is it? When was it? How did it come about? Generally, we are talking between the 9th and the 12th centuries here, roughly speaking then from around 1000 AD to about 1400 AD. I'm going to focus chiefly on England here, because that is the place where free market capitalism first flourished. So, let's go back to basics, and I want to take you through a few slides here. This image that you're looking at now is the Great Chain of Being. This was the medieval Christian thinking that held that the whole of society was built around a golden chain that hung from heaven and God up in the sky to Satan down in hell. And I just want to play you this clip from a great film from the 1920s called Haxan, which is about devil worship and witchcraft in the medieval period. This is William S. Burroughs in the American dub. Enjoy.
The globe and its waters were seen as the center of the universe. Outside this, the Middle Ages postulated first a layer of air, then a layer of fire. Beyond this layer of fire moved the planets. Each planet was fixed in its sphere, which was mobile and transparent. Beyond the planets, the stars were attached to another sky. In the outermost circle, Almighty God was enthroned, surrounded by 9 angelic choirs. And it was God who controlled the world machinery. In the bowels of the earth was hell and its eternal torments, one of which was to find yourself being put into a boiling cauldron. Here, one of the damned is thrown directly into the fire. Here's a demon giving one of the damned a drink of horrid brimstone liquid. This scene gives an accurate picture of the conceptions of the Middle Ages. Look at these two demons stoking the fire so energetically beneath the cauldron.
So one interesting aspect of the Great Chain of Being is that they had subdivided the entire life on Earth into 5 different kingdoms. You had the spiritual kingdom, that's God, angels, various ministering spirits, your cherubs and so on. Then below that you had the animal kingdom, lions, tigers, dogs, cats, and in between those two was mankind, of course, the link between the spiritual kingdom and the animal kingdom. And then below that you have your vegetables, your various plants, carrots and so on. Below that, minerals, that's stones, earth, inanimate objects, basically. And then below that you have the elemental kingdom, various gaseous forms or vapors, things like that. Here is another way of presenting all of that information, and then some helpful chap on the internet did it like this. Now you'll notice a few curiosities here. You can see that man is above woman in the Great Chain, and also you'll notice that demons are just below angels there. And of course, the reason for that is that the demons are actually fallen angels. They're only down in hell as a punishment from God. And even Lucifer himself, in theory, could get forgiven if only he were to overcome his pride and ask God for forgiveness. Maybe he'd be let back into heaven. But of course, as the story goes, Satan won't do that, so he's trapped eternally down in hell. Anyway, another little curiosity is that within each of the five kingdoms, there are various rankings. So, for example, the animal kingdom was ranked. You had your lions and the elephant right at the top, and then down the bottom you had the likes of deer, rabbits, and things like that. You can see the eagle was considered to be the king of the birds, and then, you know, the seed-eating birds like the sparrow were down at the bottom. So everything, even within each of the kingdoms, had ranks. The angels had ranks, even the planets had ranks. The sun was said to be above the moon, which was said to be above the planets and the stars. The elements all had ranks. Fire was above air, was above water, was above earth. And even beyond that, the different humours each had ranks. So bile was said to be above blood, for example, which was said to be above phlegm. Now, of particular interest to us here are the ranks, of course, of human beings, of mankind. Now, as I've already mentioned, men were above women, and there is actually a logic behind that, internally consistent with this system. It actually sounds quite bonkers to us now, but essentially they believe that men had more choler in them. They had more hot blood. And because of that, it meant that their genitals were able to protrude, whereas the colder and more sluggish women, being colder and full of phlegm, meant that their genitals remained stranded within. So essentially they saw men and women as being variations on the same basic model, and the temperature essentially dictates whether you're a man or a woman. Sounds ridiculous, but within their own system, I guess it makes sense. Anyway, this chart here is the important thing. This is how men were ranked. The higher up this chart you are, the closer to God you were said to be. So obviously the king at the top, and then a duke who's above an earl, who's above your commoner, garden baron, and the knights, and of course the peasants right down the bottom there. The best way of understanding this system is to grasp that everybody within it had what is known as a liege. A liege is, I would think of it as your boss for life. And to understand how this works fully, we need to take it right down to the level of the medieval village or the manor. Here you have a baron, and under the baron you have all of the peasants. The lord of the manor would be the liege for each of the individual peasants. Now, of course, all this talk of great chains of being and lieges and vassals is all the post hoc justification for the economic system at the heart of this. And this village that we're looking at holds the key of understanding this economic system. You can see that the fields have all been separated into strips, and on each of these strips a peasant and his family would live and work. Typically, they'd have a cottage or a little house in the village, and they'd have a strip of land to work on. Now, I want to come back to the peasants in a moment, but just to understand the basics of this system, just assume for the second that the peasants paid the baron in taxes. That could be a portion of the food that they farmed off the land, or it could be in money. But the baron himself would also have a liege, and you can go up the chain. So the baron's liege would be, for example, an earl who could have several barons under him, and this is a screenshot from the game Crusader Kings 2. If you want to understand, I guess, the macroeconomics of this system, playing that game to the point where you understand what you're doing will get you most of the way there. But you can see here that the Earl, he has a whole area with a number of different barons under him, and the barons would supply the Earl with taxes in money, and they would also supply him with military might, with men, if he needed to raise them in war. And so it goes on up the chain. The earls would report in to a duke, and they would provide him with money and taxes, and also with men. And so it goes on up the line, all the way to the king. And you can see here that, I don't know, in England there'd be three or four dukes at any one time, who would have a number of earls and other lords under them, and just the one king. This made dukes incredibly powerful in the feudal system, because you know, all it would take is one or two rogue dukes not to lend their support to the king, and all of a sudden the king may find himself outnumbered. And of course, this happened time and again in the medieval period. The War of the Roses is a pretty good example. Factionalism is one of the great weaknesses of feudalism as a political system. So anyway, you understand the basics, but let's go back to this village, because I think there are some nuances to the economics here that aren't widely understood. Let's zoom in. Okay, so now I've added a little bit more detail to this. So you can see that it's not quite as simple as there being a baron and then just a bunch of peasants. The economic relationships within this town are a little bit more complex. There were two different types of peasant that we can separate broadly into freeholders and bondmen, also known as serfs, or as in this country especially, villeins. So what is a freeholder and what is a bondsman or villein or serf? The best way to think of the freeholder is as having a lifetime tenancy agreement, whereby he rented out the land for a fixed term annual sum for all of his life. This meant that the peasant was essentially free to do as he wished on his strip of land. He would farm, he could maybe go and sell that stuff at the local market. Most of the time he'd probably just eat it himself. You know, he made his own way, as long as he paid the tenancy fees, the local rents and the taxes to the baron. There may have been additional kind of ad hoc tributes or other such things that he had to give to the baron, but in exchange, in theory, the baron would be giving him protection and the lands to live on. The bondman, or the serf, or the villain, meanwhile, had no such relationship. They didn't really have to pay rents to stay on the land, or if they did, it was a very, very low level, and in the form of food rather than money. But also, by the same token, they did not get a wage, they did not make any money, but instead they were bonded to the baron in the form of an oath of fealty. Now, when they first started, these oaths were pretty harsh. Basically, the original serfs back in like 700 AD would have been people who had fallen on hard times. Maybe there was a bad harvest one year, or there had been floods that had wrecked the fields, or maybe the Vikings had come and pillaged and taken everything. And so a serf was somebody who was left with nothing and who had little chance, I guess, of making their own way in the world. So they would, in essence, fall at the feet of some lord or other and pledge their services to that lord for life, and more devastatingly, pledge the allegiance of their son or daughter and all of their subsequent offspring till the end of time, in theory, to that lord, or indeed his offspring. And the deal here was that the bondman or serf would be given a place to live, and they would be given a strip of land by the lord, but in exchange for I don't know, 3 or 4 days labor a week, they would give most of their productive output, most of the things that they made on these fields, to the baron, and then with the rest of their time they could work the land for their own subsistence. So if you can imagine the average week of your serf, you may work 4 days, I don't know, harvesting turnips or whatever to give to the lord, and then the rest of the time you're making food for your own family. Now, as you can see, there's not just fields in this village. There's also a blacksmith, church, little mill there. And the baron, if he saw fit, may reallocate the labour of these villeins to one of these other occupations. So, for example, I don't know, there may be a local tavern, and they're making their own beer there, and they needed an ale taster, for example. And, you know, maybe if you're in the Lord's good books, he might make you an ale taster that week. So really, he was your boss. You did as he told you for the entirety of your life, and the best you could hope for was a cushy job within the town. Peasants, meanwhile, the freeholders, were free to do as they pleased. They were under no such obligations. Their only obligation, really, to the lord was to pay those rents and taxes. And just a quick word here on the knights. If you remember, the deal between the baron and, say, the earl above him, or the earl and the king, is that when the time came, they would be able to lend military support if their liege ever needed it. And also, if you recall the deal between the peasantry and the baron, he, in exchange for their labour and the use of the land, would also be providing them protection so that the village was a nice, safe place to live. So the baron was able to facilitate all of this by making separate deals with knights. And here the exchange is land for military service. The baron would give the knight a place to live and some land, and in exchange he would pledge his sword, that is, his military skills and expertise, to the baron. And whenever the baron would need to use military might for any reason, whether helping his lord or protecting the village, the knights would be pressed into service. So they had their own oath of fealty, a kind of separate knightly one, and this is how that part of things was dealt with. Now, historians differ over the amount of freeholders versus the amount of serfs or villeins at any one time in Britain. But we do know that in 1086, under William the Conqueror, in the Domesday Book, it says that England comprised 12% freeholders, 35% serfs or villeins, 30% cotters and boarders, and 9% slaves. Incidentally, slavery in England was abolished after 1102 under the Normans, and this later became the basis for why slavery was abolished across the British Empire much later in history. It's also worth noting that a cotter or a boarder is basically one rung down from a villein. And so a villein would have a house and a cottage. A cottager would just have a little cottage. So it's essentially just a lower class of serf who had a smaller amount of land and a smaller place to live. I should mention, though, that if you think these people had it rough, they did have between 1 to 5 acres each, which is no, you know, that's quite a bit of land by today's standards. So in some ways they had decent access to land. In other ways, I mean, none of us would want to trade our positions with a serf, a villain, a cotter, or a boarder. Trust me. Now, by the late 1200s and early 1300s, the situation has shifted somewhat. Some people estimate that there were around 60% unfree peasants. Others think that the number has come down to about 40% who are villeins. Others put it at 50-50, freeholders versus serfs. I've put a link in the notes to a very good article by Zivi Razi called Serfdom and Freedom in Medieval England, A Reply to Revisionists. You can look over that in your own time. But the key thing to take away is that it was about 50-50 between serfs and freeholders by the mid-1300s. By 1500, there were virtually no serfs left in England at all. Why is that? What happened to this system? Why did it fall apart? Well, for the answer to that, I've turned to Spencer Dimmock's Origin of Capitalism in England, 1400 to 1600, which is a very good survey of all of the research done on this. If you're interested, I would Google the name Robert Brenner, who seems to be the key theorist or the key historian who has looked at this transition point between feudalism to capitalism. But this this book by Spencer Dimmock is pretty up to date and shows all the different sides of the argument. Well, anyway, he draws attention to the fact that it was possible for the serf to buy his own freedom, essentially to buy himself out of the bondage contract. That is not as expensive as you might think. It was only a few shillings, about 7 shillings, to buy yourself out of this bondage. And in France, that is essentially what happened over this period. More and more serfs bought themselves into freedom. But in England, this didn't happen. Now, some Marxist historians have tried to argue that it didn't happen because the serfs were, they didn't want the freedom. They would prefer to stick with the land that they had, and they were safe, and basically life wasn't that bad living under the protection of the baron. Dimmock disagrees with this quite a lot, and he says it wasn't that the serfs didn't want their freedom in England, it's that the English lords didn't give them the option as the French lords did. And this was one of the key reasons why in 1381 the peasants revolted. There's a famous peasants' revolt in England under Richard II during that. One thing I think it's easy to forget is that the freeholder peasants and the villeins would have all been friends. They would have married each other. It would have been very common for a freeholder and a villein to be in the same family, for example. So what happened in 1381 is that all of the peasants, the freeholders, the villeins, they rose up and they said, look, we have to stop this practice of vassalage and serfdom. We want all of the lords to set the villeins free. Essentially make everybody a freeholder and stop this serfdom nonsense. But this uprising was brutally suppressed by the lords, who of course had a lot more military might than the peasants would be able to have. You know, they had better weapons. They rounded up the leaders, brutally put them down, and the peasants' revolt came to naught. They didn't get what they wanted on that occasion. But after this time, argues Dimmock, with this newfound quest for freedom, or at least freeholder status pumping through their veins, there was a renewed will for villeins to get away from their villages. There'd been a long-standing rule that if a serf was able to escape his village and remain gone for a whole calendar year, he would attain free status. So what we see after 1381 is mass migration from these little hamlets and villages to towns and urban areas. All of these villeins, wanting to become freemen, flee to the cities. And this is where we get the rise of urbanization. So by 1400 AD, under Henry IV, feudalism was in chronic decline. By 1500 AD, after the War of the Roses and during the reign of Henry VII, it was practically over. Now, over this stretch of history, this 100 years from 1400 to 1500 AD, an awful lot of things happen, and you could easily fill several libraries over with books written on this. I mean, I could easily do a series many, many hours long just on this topic alone. So in the interest of brevity and to try to be as circumspect as possible, I will just zoom in on the key thing that happens in 1453 AD, and that is that Mehmed II conquers Constantinople, and in so doing shuts down the ancient Silk Road, thereby cutting off Western Europe's access to the East. And this has several dramatic consequences. One of those consequences is that scholars who had been ensconced in Greece and in Constantinople flee, and they go west. They land in Italy, in places like Venice, Genoa, and Florence. And in those places, learned men, scholars who had been reading, I guess, Christian scriptures for the past 1,000 years, were suddenly reconnected with the ancient Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, Ptolemy, you name it, they were reconnected with them. And that in itself led to this spirit of rediscovery and of excitement of being reconnected with what they perceived at that time as a golden age in the past. And it didn't take them very long to figure out where the Greeks had gone wrong. So you can see, for example, very quickly that Ptolemy, who had worked out quite a few things but got other significant things wrong, when he's picked up by Copernicus doesn't take him long to figure out that a few of these things are wrong. And just think of the impact of Copernicus's discovery there. You find out that the Earth is going around the Sun rather than the Sun going around the Earth. I mean, it's simply mind-blowing. Your entire concept of the universe is blown apart just by that one discovery. On top of that, the closing of the Silk Road also gave traders a commercial imperative now to take to the seas. I mean, if you're setting off from Europe and you want to get to India and you've got the ancient Silk Road cut off, what are you going to do? You can either go over Russia, and as various people in history, including Napoleon and Hitler, have found, that's not a very good idea. Or you could get in a ship and try to sail around the south of Africa there, which even today remains a very choppy and difficult journey. The waters around that part of Africa aren't very favourable, shall we say, and some traders did do that. So you find Europeans making contact with South African peoples, you know, in the early 1500s, or as Christopher Columbus did, you can go west, and since they knew from the time of Ptolemy onwards that the world was round, you know, he figured that you'd come out round the other side and see India, and everybody, of course, knows the rest. He made a significant discovery. So not only now are you living in a world where you can find out that the Earth is going around the Sun, and not vice versa, you also now live in a world where they've discovered that new continents that you didn't even know were there now exist. So it's an incredibly exciting time to be alive. Around 1500 AD, new scientific discoveries, new geographic discoveries. On top of that, there's also the small matter of the European Reformation, the rise of Martin Luther in Germany, the Anabaptists in Holland and the Low Countries, John Calvin, of course, in Geneva. And in the next video, I want to look at the combined impact of all of these things and how it led ultimately to the rise of capitalism. In this video, what I focused on is how feudalism worked and why that system started to break down. Just to put a capper on it and to draw out the conclusions if they weren't strong enough, feudalism broke down in England because peasants fled their villages and ended up in towns. So the rise of urbanisation, the rise of the cities, is directly related to the decline of the old-fashioned feudal way of life. In France, it's a slightly different story. As I mentioned, the peasantry essentially bought their own freedom by paying the small fees to get out of bondage. Now, although in the next video I won't be talking about feudalism very much, I'll be talking much more about the rise of capitalism. This part of it, the decline of feudalism part, is significant because there is no parallel decline of serfdom, at least, in other parts of Europe. Just to give it quick recap, in England, after 1381, there is a pretty rapid decline of serfdom. There is a parallel decline in France over the same period. You get a decline in Germany as the guilds and the cities grow up for largely the same reason as it happened here in the UK. Sweden, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries had no history of serfdom at all. They only ever had freeholder peasants in those countries, or at least serfdom was small. So basically most of Northern Europe didn't have serfdom by about 1500 AD. But in Eastern Europe, and in places like Hungary and Russia and Czechoslovakia and Croatia and all of these sorts of places, serfdom persists. It persists all the way up until, in the case of Russia, the 1917 revolution. I mean, they were still trying to deal with serfdom at the early part of the 20th century in Russia. And that's one reason why it wasn't right for communism, according to Marx, because they hadn't even moved past serfdom in their system. It's also a reason why that part of Europe stayed economically backwards during the period of growth and prosperity that I'm going to talk about in the next video. So the decline of feudalism doesn't lead directly to the rise of capitalism, but it is a significant factor holding the rest of Europe back, and it's a significant factor for why capitalism was able to take root in places like Britain and in France. More about that next time. I hope you're enjoying. I mean, this is some pretty heavy stuff I've been going through. Let me know if you've enjoyed it, and hopefully I'll be able to get the next part up reasonably quickly. Thank you very much.